Hey guys, welcome back to Campaign War Stories. My name is Wesley Donahue, and today I'm joined by Tommy Knepper, who is the owner of Infield Strategies. In this episode, we go very deep into paid door-to-door phones and what used to be considered volunteer activities.
Tommy, how's it going, man?
Good, good. How are you doing, Wesley?
Good. Appreciate you coming on. This is going to be a good one because you being a field guy and owning a field company is something we really haven't covered yet. So I want to dive in deep. But first, I want to know, like, how did you get into politics, man? Tell me about your career.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. And thank you for having me on. Happy to talk about field stuff. So I started years ago. I had gotten out of college and went to UCLA. I'd been working doing sales, wasn't really feeling it. Went and joined the Army. When I got back from basic training before I went to OCS, I took an unpaid internship in a political office because I had saved some money up during basic training and was looking for something else to do and caught the bug almost right away. And so as soon as I came back from OCS and I was in the Guard, they offered me a paid job. And so I started working in a state assembly office in California. Worked on his first, that assembly member ran for state Senate. And so I worked on his state Senate campaign. And that's when I caught the bug for campaigns as opposed to the official side. And, went from that to work on the mayor's race in 12 and, ran a congressional race in 14 and, worked for the RNC in 16 and started my company in 17. So, it kind of escalated quickly, but yeah, once I got into it, man, we all have that feeling like you catch that bug and it's hard to walk away. It's a unique world, but it's a fun one. So I've been here since.
How did you gravitate towards the field side of the industry?
Yeah, I mean, part of that was my Army training. I was trained as an officer to lead a bunch of men in the field. And so my institutional knowledge at that point in terms of how to structure a large campaign, how to deal with managers to canvasser ratio, all of that stuff kind of fell naturally in. And so as I started working on the campaign side in 2012, especially in the mayor's race, they elevated me to deputy campaign manager to run the entire field program citywide in San Diego. We had maybe 100 people. And so structurally, though, it ran soundly, ran smoothly. And so and I kind of fell in love with that side of it right away. And I've always enjoyed managing people anyways. That's part of the reason I got into politics is I enjoy, talking to people and convincing people to vote for our guys. And so and managing people. And so that's why I kind of fell into it. And I've been doing it really ever since. I mean, yeah, I've managed some races. I've done some general consulting, but my strength has always been on the field side. Sure.
What made you want to be an entrepreneur and go out and start your own thing and do it on your own?
Yeah, I mean, I've always had that, coming through college, I actually started a recording studio and record label. I went to UCLA, like
really?
I said, and I had a couple bands that I was managing and taking around the LA circuit and bringing them to San Diego to some of the big clubs and bars. And so we ultimately failed. We folded up, realized that wasn't a lifetime career, but I've always had the entrepreneur spirit. And so, after working for the RNC in 16, decided to start a field company, realizing there was a need in the Republican side for some good field companies and field programs. And so we started the company. Me and my business partner started in early 2017. I've been doing it ever since. And we love it. I mean, we got into it knowing that we could fill this void on the Republican side for lack of field. The Democrats had hundreds of firms. Republicans had like three or four. And so we knew there was a gap there that we could fill and fill it effectively and jumped into it. And it's worked since. But we love it.
All right. So explain what the company does.
Yeah. So we're a paid grassroots outreach firm. So we do everything from door knocking, signature gathering for ballot access or initiatives, peer-to-peer texting, phone calls, really anything that's person-to-person outreach. Now, we started with just canvassing, just door-to-door canvassing, but we've kind of grown into all-encompassing grassroots. And so when we started, we hyper-focused on data collection, making sure everything that we were collecting was accurate, that our canvassers were actually at the doors that they were supposed to be at, that they were actually doing the job, not sitting at McDonald's entering a bunch of data like we've all seen people do over the years.
Yeah.
And so we went in with the idea that we want to create the best product and then, start marketing that and really try to win campaigns, not just have a company. And so it's worked out well for us. With that mindset always is, we're there to win and put the best foot forward, not just to, make money. And as a result, we've continued to grow over the years.
So, I mean, this was traditionally something that volunteers took care of on a campaign, right? Like when I was coming up, there was no paid, like you couldn't pay people to go door to door. I mean, like we had to put together these massive volunteer armies. And I felt like we were not in South Carolina because it's a red state, but in other states we played in, we were always outmatched because the Democrats would volunteer way more than Republicans would. Maybe they just got more time on their hands. I don't know. But we were always outmatched. So it's good that we have this paid side now. But like, explain how that happened. Explain how we went from volunteers to now paying people, and explain how that whole process works.
Yeah. So when we, again, when we started getting into it, the Democrats were outmatching us. They're outmatching us with volunteers for sure, but they're also outmatching us with paid staff. And they were going and hiring, you know, a bunch of people in inner cities, in suburban areas where they could do the outreach. And obviously those doors are a lot closer together. And so they're easier to canvas. And they were beating us in that medium over and over again, every cycle, as far as we could tell, in terms of the number, the sheer quantity of doors they were knocking and the quality that they were knocking. I mean, volunteers are great. I love a good community volunteer. The quality is not going to be the same as someone that you've trained and professionally, you know, taught how to canvas. And so they were just beating us that medium. And so I think the Republican Party, especially after the Obama years, started catching on that our volunteer force cannot compete with their combined volunteer and paid force. So our party started catching up. And then I think what put the nail in the coffin for the volunteer outreach, which really doesn't exist anymore, is COVID. I mean, it was already headed that way anyways. Most of the canvassing outreach was gravitating towards paid outreach, but COVID really, since COVID happened, very few volunteers are willing to go door to door anymore. It's just not really something they're comfortable with anymore.
So I'm asking this question genuinely because I have zero idea how your business works. So without giving away any trade secrets or processes that make your company special, like how do you find so many people? How do you vet them to make sure they're not crazies? You know, I remember it was here in South Carolina that I remember a story, and I hope it wasn't your firm. You weren't working for DeSantis, I don't think, right? Okay, good. I want to make sure I'm not screwing you over here. But I remember like there was that video that went viral of that kid who like was cursing at the door and all that. So like, how do you find so many human beings? How do you vet them? How do you train them? Like, how does that work?
Yeah. And I mean, part of that process is setting up a good process on the front side, right? And having the experience and knowing that you're going to get people that are only in it for cash, people that are potentially even working against you and they're trying to infiltrate your organization. And so we've learned all those trades over the years. And so we have a full vetting process. I mean, it starts with a social media check where we go on their social media and make sure they're not, you know, outlandish. Really on either side, you don't want them crazy right or crazy left person at the door espousing their own ideas and not representing your candidate. So start with social media check. We run a full criminal background check. So we do social media, phone interview, face-to-face interview, criminal background check, and then 2 full days of training. So we train them in a classroom. We do role playing, you know, set up scenes, go through rebuttals, all that stuff. And then we have them actually go out in the field and canvas with one of our managers and make sure that they understand what they're doing and the concept that they're going after and trying to relay to the voter. To say, you know, what happened with DeSantis was bad. It's never perfect when you're hiring thousands of people across the country. Of course, you're going to get some bad apples here or there. But for the most part, we're able to weed out the less ideal people up front. And really over the years, I mean, we're coming up on our 8th year of business now. We've hired tens of thousands of people. So we've kept lists of everyone who's good, everyone we want to bring back, everyone we want to hire. You know, we've worked in 40 of the 50 states. So we've got people all over the country and in each region where we can, you know, pull on at least a core kind of tiger team of experienced professionals to kickstart the campaign and to keep everyone else that's a new hire honest because we know they're trustworthy. So through a combined effort of, you know, we've gotten there.
I mean, like, I would be stressed all the time if I were you because I feel like the stressful part of being an entrepreneur isn't doing the work because that's actually a lot of fun. Clients are stressful always, but like, the stress comes in the people, like the humans that you're managing. And I wouldn't sleep at night if I knew that I had like thousands of people that were on my payroll across the country. Like, how do you sleep, man? That doesn't stress you out?
It does. I mean, you get used to kind of handling certain fire drills, right? And part of that comes with experience too. Like most issues that happen are fixable. I'm sure even with the DeSantis one, while it was a bad news cycle, they probably were able to fix it, assuming they were a professional team. I don't know who they were, but when when the proverbial, you know, stuff hits the fan, it's definitely stressful. But you know, you kind of go through each day, you put all the barriers in place, you have the right people in place, the right managers in place, right, the HR department, you know, make sure you have the right insurances, all the backside stuff that goes into a full large company we have in place. And so again, do you get some bad actors here or there? Sure. But any company does. And, you know, we handle those as they come.
And these aren't typically going to be full-time employees, right? So, and they're not volunteers. Like what are these people?
Yeah. So our core staff is full-time. So our full HR department, accounting department, you know, we have managers that kind of stay out with us year round or, you know, all the time. Most of the canvassers are more or less seasonal employees or temporary employees. You know, they're contract workers. So they are W-2 employees. We don't do any 1099s. It's just too dangerous in a lot of states with labor laws. So they're all W-2, but they are, you know, temporary or seasonal typically.
Oh, I didn't even think about that because I know you guys play across the country. I mean, we've done races in every corner of the country together. So, I mean, not only do you have the federal laws, but you also got these state employment laws that you have to follow too. So that's got to be like an HR nightmare, right?
Yes. You got to make sure you're filing all your proper paperwork to make sure you can work in that state. Make sure you're doing all the taxes according to that state's labor laws. Make sure you're following those labor laws. So what we've done for the most part is we've set our company infrastructure up to handle the most severe states, like in New York or California. And then by default, the less severe states are, you know, easier to handle.
And you're finding mostly people that are local to that area, right? Because you don't want a good old boy from Monk's Corner, South Carolina, knocking on a door in like LA or in, I don't know, Oregon or Washington, right?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, we always try to find an higher local. I mean, some of the managers we parachute in just because they have experience we need, but the canvassers going door to door. I mean, you've been all over the country. There's so many different dialects across the country. You don't want somebody from Louisiana talking to someone in Minnesota. They won't understand each other. So you always try to find a higher local and make sure it's a, you know, local community member.
Nice. So I read an article, maybe it was last year, about a canvasser that was caught. You know, you brought it up, like sitting in a McDonald's parking lot, just punched it in the numbers and actually wasn't knocking on these doors. I'm sure you read that same article. What are you guys doing to prevent that kind of fraud and to weed out those kind of, I mean, you explained like the hiring process, but do you have like mechanisms in place to ensure that kind of fraud doesn't happen?
We do. Yeah. So, I mean, going back to what you're talking about, the volunteer days, the old school days before you had these fancy apps and, you know, you're still using like bubble sheets and kind of scanning everything in. Yeah. We still use those old kind of analog checks as well as the modern technology. So we always start with the sight and sniff test. You know, if they were out canvassing in northern San Diego in 80 degree temperature in California for 7 hours, when they come back to the office, do they look and smell like they were canvassing for 7 hours in 80 degree heat? It's an easy check. Or do they look like they were sitting in air conditioning somewhere? So that's the first check. We do spot checks. So as the people come back, they, you know, they talk to 25% of folks. We'll have the managers call them. Hey, our canvassers in the area had a conversation with you. You know, you said you were a supporter of our person, wanted to follow up and see if you had any follow-up questions. And usually, you know, most of the time, assuming they're doing their job, the voter's happy that we called. Oh, yeah, hey, great. Every once in a while, you'll get a voter who's like, I don't know what you're talking about. No one came to my door. So then you continue extra calls on that canvasser, and you'll figure out if they were fudging the data or not. The modern technology has obviously made it easier. So most of the canvassing apps we use have geotagging. So that'll tell you, you know, within a 10-meter radius where the person was when they were entering the data. It'll track kind of their general canvassing route. And then we also, my business partner has a data background. So we set up our own internal warehouse. Where we run all of our canvassing data through it, and we've set up our own alert. So it will literally alert us in 15-minute increments if the canvasser is walking too fast or too slow, meaning like in that 15 minutes, they say they canvass 45 homes, which is, you know, a home every 20 seconds, like you can't do that. Or in that 15 minutes, they only canvass one home. It'll tell us if they're too far away from the house when they enter the data. It'll tell us if they're in the same geolocation to enter multiple sets of data. And we have a few other, you know, kind of flags that alert us, contact rate too high or too low. So we've got it to where you're still going to get cheaters, but we'll catch it in the 15 or 30 minute intervals where the amount of data you have is, you know, maybe 20, 30 homes that you have to back out, not an entire day or week of bad data that you have to parse through and figure out what was good and bad.
Okay. So given that we are in the middle of hot primary season, about to go into the general election, approximately about how many human beings are you paying right now?
Right now, we've got about 400 or so on approximately. And I think that'll scale up.
Oh, yeah, obviously, Jesus. That's insane. How many do you think you'll get to this year? 1,000?
I think we'll go over 1,000, depending how everything shakes out. It really depends how many states we're in, but yeah.
That's wild. That's wild. Like, I mean, I am so stressed out of my brain with 90 people all the time, dude. I don't know how you're doing it. How is technology? I mean, you explained it a little bit just now, but has technology completely changed the game with the ability for those folks to, you know, report responses in real time?
I think it has. I mean, it's allowed the data entry side. It used to be when we had those old bubble sheets, you know, you'd go back and you had a day or two of lag time before you could even enter the data. And then the systems themselves that manipulated the data weren't always that useful. And so as a result, people canvassed for the voter touch. They never really used the data. I think the technology now, in terms of the, you know, the accuracy of the data, making sure that the person is actually talking to folks and not entering bad data, and then also the quickness with which you're getting it in and how robust it can be, has allowed us to share. I mean, with a lot of our canvassing projects, we integrate with the data team, whether it's a, you know, just a traditional polling or micro-targeting or modeling firm, whatever level they're at, to where we're feeding all of that data back into their algorithms. They're recrunching the numbers. And so I think it's helped integrate the canvassing, I think, a lot more into an overall campaign plan, as opposed to something that used to be, you know, we knew canvassing was useful. We knew we wanted to talk to voters, especially during GOTV, but it wasn't really utilized. The data wasn't utilized much beyond that. And now with the technology, we use the data across the board. It's basically a, you know, everyday mini focus group or mini poll at the door that is useful across the board.
You know, going into 2020, I was telling people that, and I'm the owner of a digital firm, that we are going to start seeing a return to a hyper focus on door to door and calls and those personal touches, because you kind of saw us getting away from it because of digital, right? And my argument was that they're just getting bombarded so much on digital channels and on TV that we're going to see a return to it. Now, as soon as I made that argument, COVID hit and you couldn't go knock on people's doors. But was I right? Are we starting to see a re-emphasis on door-to-door and calls and that personal touch in a digital world?
Big time. I think you were spot on. That wave has definitely come back. I mean, there's exactly to your point. They're getting bombarded with so much digital. You know, they have so many different TV options now, or they're streaming or whatever they're on. And they can go access their own online data. One of the mediums that still cuts through all that clutter is a face-to-face interaction. It's become less common in our society. And even really even since COVID, it's started to come back, but people are still reluctant a lot of times to engage in face-to-face conversations, or they work from home more often. So that face-to-face interaction at the door really does cut through in a big way. And we've seen it in the numbers. I mean, the amount that you can kind of shift the electorate with a long, not just a GOTV program, but a long haul, you know, identification and persuasion program where your canvassers are building rapport with the voters, with the community over months and months, has really paid dividends in the elections that we've worked on. So, yeah, I think you were spot on. I mean, and I think it's going to continue going that way in the immediate future, at least.
All right. So my last question before you tell your campaign story, and this could be one of the stories, you know, it seems that the world has become less friendly. And I might be wrong, but it seems to me that we are less neighborly than we used to be. Are you seeing a problem with people going door to door? Are there any arguments, violence, like what the hell are you doing knocking on my door and who are you? Because when I was knocking on doors, you know, 20 years ago, it wasn't a problem at all, but it just seemed like, and also we were down here in the South Carolina area when I was a volunteer, and this is supposedly the friendliest state in the country, so maybe my barometer is a little off, but have we become less neighborly and less friendly to people knocking on our doors?
It's not universal. I think a lot of it's state by state. You can kind of look at the individual states' responses to COVID to kind of judge like which states I'm talking about go which direction. Yeah. But in general, yes. I mean, in general, I would say yes. And to the extent that we've been able to counteract it, it's really just been with more identification. So where in the past, mm-hmm. we kind of just walk around with lit and maybe a clipboard or a tablet or a smartphone, and people were fine answering the door, they're less likely to do that now. And so you have to adapt. I mean, we'll have either hats or at least lanyards or more identification on them to show it's more of a formal Like, it's not just someone walking up to your door to sell you something necessarily. It's, you know, it's a someone canvassing for a political campaign, or at least looks official, and then they're more likely to answer the door. And so we've adapted that. Even in the past, we always tried to have swag, but again, it wasn't necessary. Now it's pretty much necessary, where you'll get people slamming the door in your face, or you'll get people that'll confront you in the community if you don't have, you know, clear identification on you, like, hey, this is what I'm working for, and I'm canvassing, you know, for a campaign that's protected by the First Amendment. We also train all of our folks, and all of our HR department is trained to chat with, you know, police if they get called, or to talk to individuals. They know the rights, and we're always very polite. But so that's another aspect where we've trained, you know, people, our staff, to handle situations appropriately also. So to answer your question in short, yes, but it's not overcomable. It's, you know, you just have to kind of adapt with the how you're going about it.
Last time a political person knocked on my door, it was a DeSantis volunteer, and my kids had just seen the chocolate pudding ad that the Trump campaign put out, and my middle kid was like, ooh, gross, your boss eats chocolate pudding with his fingers, and the kid was like, didn't know what to say. All right, so he got off guard there. I think he did. All right, man, so during your time doing this, do you have any favorite campaign stories, or a story?
Yeah, I've got two. One that relates to all the data integrity stuff we're talking about. One that's just kind of funny because the guy was a quirky dude. So the first one relates to the campaign, like data integrity, and that goes back to 2012 when the data wasn't quite there. I think Advantage BridgeTree had been out a little bit, maybe a couple other apps, but not many. And so they didn't really have much data integrity yet. And so we used the old school system, the sight and smell, the calling people after they talk to them, the spot checking. And so these two guys who we were pretty sure were trying to spy on us from one of the unions, because our candidate would have been the Republican mayor of San Diego and the unions were anti him, came in. You know, they didn't seem like they had canvassed. So the next day we did the spot check. Sure enough, nothing. Rather than just confronting them, we wanted to send a message. So because I told you I had about 100 staff. So rather than just confronting them, I had my deputy go and tail him and shadow him for the next day. So we gave him a walkbook, act like it was normal. He shadowed him. They drove down, far away. The walkbook was in northern San Diego. They drove to southern San Diego. We're not sure exactly they met with, but they met with some folks, came back 8 hours later. I had him take pictures of their car about where they had parked, just so I had proof that, like, obviously you guys were in the right area. And so I printed out the pictures I had laying across my desk, and I left all the doors open to the rest of the campaign office because we'd have the canvassers come back in the evening to make calls. And so I was like, hey, you know, were you guys canvassing? Where were you at? And they said, oh, we went and canvassed in, you know, Mira Mesa. And I was like, okay, like, did you go south for any reason? Like, you know, go get lunch or something? Like, no. And just, I kept asking questions, have them bury themselves. And so then I started flipping over the three photos on the desk slowly. And they both looked at me and they're like, we're sorry. And I was like, the only question I didn't know is, you know, which union were you spying on us for? And how much information did you feed them? And they ended up telling me and then left. And I was like, obviously you're fired. And they're like, we know. But and the whole office, so it cracked down on the spine after that. But it was a fun one. Sometimes you got to send a signal up front to the rest of the staff to make sure they know they get caught.
That's great, because I think that, like, that story kind of eases the anxiety, I think, of a candidate to hire paid folks, right? Like, you're on the lookout for this shit, and you've been doing it for so long that you find it.
Oh yeah, you find it. Yep. Yeah, and then again, I usually don't go to that much that length, but we had to, like I said, we had to set an example, and it worked. We didn't have anyone else do that. We had people cut corners, but no one else tried to do the whole spying on us thing. So, and I followed that rule. I've trained my managers and staff always the same. They're always trying to ensure that the data we're collecting is accurate. So that was I learned that in 2012, and I've never forgot it. It's always nice. A fun one.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
One of the other ones was just a quirky guy in 2014 running a congressional race. The guy's parents were heavily involved in Republican, like, just, you know, volunteer, the local GOP. He was just a funny dude. And so one day he would canvass for us and make calls. And he came back one day. He went out to lunch. And he came back like 3 hours later. And we didn't know where he went. And they had been messaging and calling him. And so when he came back, he had said he'd been looking for a submarina. Something crazy happened where a piano almost fell on his head. The original submarine that he went to was closed. He couldn't figure it out. And so 3 hours later, he comes back. The story seemed weird, but, you know, he'd worked for us for several months. He was doing the job. It was just kind of a weird, like, okay. So a week later, we see a story in the newspaper about a robbery that happened at a convenience store down the street from the office. As we're reading it, we're like, man, that was like a block down the street. And the kid comes in. He's like, yeah, I was in that convenience store. And we're like, what are you talking about? When? He's like, that day I was not for 3 hours. He conveniently left out the fact that he was in a store that got held up at gunpoint and sat there for an hour while they got robbed, then talked to the cops. When he walked out of the store, the piano did almost fall on his head. That was in the news story too. And then he saw a submarine, so he got a sandwich, but left out the whole like middle part.
Wild. Why would he just tell you that?
I don't know. He was just kind of an odd dude. And again, like a good guy, was just like, why didn't you tell us that the whole time? Like, so he left out arguably the most important part of his story. It's like, yeah, you could have led with that.
That's wild, man. That's wild. Well, dude, how are you? You're still in Charleston, right?
Yep. Yeah.
How are you loving it? And how did you get to Charleston, by the way? That'll be the very last question. How did you get to Charleston?
First of all, loving it very much. The kids have settled in. It's just everything we hoped it would be when we moved here. Nice. In terms of community and school and everything else. We've lived in a few different parts of the country. We were born and raised in Southern California, but California is not the California that I grew up in, or at least San Diego's not. And so we were looking at the map. We lived in Pennsylvania for the 15, 16 cycle. So we knew we didn't like the Northeast winters. We like being coastal. And so we just started looking at the Southeast, looked at some spots in Florida, looked at the Gulf, looked at Savannah and Charleston, just fell in love with this city. So we didn't know anyone here, but we loved the culture. We love, you know, it reminds me of San Diego like 25 years ago. It's that big, it's got all the big city aspects, but a small town feel. It's great for the kids. And so we love it.
We had dinner last year, maybe it was even the year before at this point, but let's get together again, man. I'd love to see you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We should definitely get together for dinner. Let me know.
All right, brother. Thanks for coming on today.
Yeah. Thank you, Wesley. Appreciate you having me on.
Thank you for listening to Campaign War Stories. Please subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also get new episodes sent straight to your inbox by subscribing at WesleyDonahue.com. I hope you have a phenomenal day full of positive vibes.